Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 101, where we will discuss the book The Motivation to Work by Frederick Hertzberg, Bernard Mausner, and Barbara Snyderman, published in 1959 by Wiley. This is part one of the episode where we present Hertzberg's studies into the question of what workers want to get out of their jobs, and this led to the development of the two-factor theory of job satisfaction. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hi, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from a very windy Leamington Spa in England.
Hi, this is Miranda, also in Leamington Spa in England and also very windy.
Well, welcome. And today we're going to go back to the theory of motivation and the motivation to work. This is a book by, Frederick Hertzberg was the principal investigator. The book is written by Hertzberg, Bernard Mausner, and Barbara Brock Snyderman. It's a trio of authors. But the outcome of this book is pretty much attributed to Hertzberg as his two-factor theory of motivation. This is a work that came from 1959 and is really a short book. I mean, it's a very concise review of a study or a series of studies that was done in the 1950s, trying to figure out what motivates people to work and why people behave at work the way that they do. Catherine, you want to give us a little quick rundown on Frederick Hertzberg?
Sure. Frederick Hertzberg was dubbed the father of job enrichment, and he was an American psychologist who became one of the most influential names in business management. He's known, as Tom mentioned, for the concept of job enrichment and the motivator hygiene theory, which was actually Hertzberg's own preference in terms of how his theory would be described as. It's often known still as the two-factor theory, and we'll probably refer to that as well today. He was born in Massachusetts in 1923 to Jewish Lithuanian immigrants and went to college in the City University of New York in 1939. He didn't finish his studies, however, because he was on active service during World War II, and he actually references Dachau concentration camp and how that influenced him in the introduction to the book. And this hugely influenced his interest in psychology. And after the war, he did complete his undergraduate degree in psychology and then went on to work at the University of Pittsburgh to complete his graduate work, where he was heavily influenced by John Flanagan, who we may talk about a little bit later, who came up with this critical incidence method, which he used in the research. And he earned a master's degree in science and public health and then completed a PhD in Pittsburgh, focusing on electric shock therapy. His first book was called Job Attitudes, Research and Opinion, and was actually published in 1957, so 2 years before this book came out. And that was the outgrowth of his work in the 1950s when he conducted a number of employee morale surveys with apparently contradictory results, which prompted him to rethink the traditional attitude measurement techniques, which follow in the book in 1959. He was awarded a Fulbright Research Scholarship in 63-64, which took him to Finland, and interestingly, on a work visa to Russia, where he's said to have worked very successfully. His book, Work and the Nature of Man, was published in 1966, so after this book. And his 1968 publication, One More Time, How Do You Motivate Employees, has allegedly, and I believe it, has sold 1.2 million reprints by 1987, and is one of the most requested articles of all time from Harvard Business Review. In 1972, Hertzberg accepted the offer from the University of Utah in Salt Lake City to become a professor of management in the College of Business. He went on to do lots of teaching and writing and spent 20 years as a consultant to government and industries around the world, developing seminars and workshops, a lot of which grew from this original text. He retired from the University of Utah in 1955 and died 5 years later in 2000.
Okay, thanks for that rundown, and that was excellent. And so what we're doing here is we're looking at the very beginnings of what was a very long line of work done in this area. So obviously we're going to be concentrating on initially on those beginning studies, and we'll delve into the follow-on work later. But just to kind of go through the book, because in terms of its length and its detail, it reads kind of like about the length of a modern Academy of Management journal article. It's 130 pages long, but it covers a background on 155 studies. You know, he basically opens the book with a review of the work that had been done previously, and he cited 155 studies, all trying to get at the central question of what do people want from their jobs? The book is broken out into three parts, and one not only goes through the literature review, but it also goes through the pilot studies. Because, as Catherine mentioned, 1957, he realizes these contradictory findings, and so he wants to go ahead and do a new study, but he wanted to make sure that the methodology that he was going to use was going to be successful. And so he details two pilot studies in part one to try to figure out what kind of things he would ask about, you know, what would be in the main study. And the pilot projects all focused on engineers and accountants mostly. He came up with, from the lessons learned from that, he then did what he called the major study. And he details the method, which is essentially storytelling. The kind of form of coding that they used reminded me very much of dramaturgical coding that's present nowadays, in which you basically encode the beginning, the middle, and the end acts of what he referred to as a sequence. Okay, so we find out the situation, what was the worker in an interview, what was it that caused them to feel satisfied or dissatisfied in the environment, what was the challenge that they faced, how did they resolve it, all that sort of thing. And then they went ahead and basically collected what came to be about 228 of these stories. And so then by figuring out what were the major themes from those 228 stories, is then when they figured out that there's factors that satisfy workers and factors that dissatisfy workers. And the factors seem to divide differently.
Yes, that's very punctual, and I think it's a good overview of the structure. I wanted to maybe focus a little bit on the methods and perhaps the critical incidents and this element of storytelling. I was going for more a narrative analysis, but I can see absolutely where you're coming from with the story element. So fundamentally, what seems to be a common thread is this idea of accessing emotions and accessing them in a more complete way. So the triggers, the stories, the before, the after. And I think considering where we are in time, this is a particularly groundbreaking approach that was quite brave for that era, especially because some of the parallels that he invokes in terms of competing literature or literature that he builds on are very much of the behavioral science sort of origins, the human relation movement, and all of those that we've also covered in previous episodes here. So I thought this was a very nice way of bringing back the human element and going to the individual single stories. I do have some points that I was perhaps a little bit disappointed if we want to talk about emotions, but maybe we'll go into those later. But definitely the acknowledgement that there is an incident or something, but it's more what is gravitating around that incident is something that I really appreciated. And not only the first factor, the two levels of factors. So one is sort of what I would call the driver, but then there's also the second one, which is the need that sits beneath. I thought that was a particularly helpful way of viewing why are we happy or not happy about our work.
Yeah, that's a good point. The chapter five is a chapter in which he defines what is the sequence. And it was a five-part construct. And this is kind of how I came up with this idea that this has a lot of storytelling to it. I wholly agree. Narrative analysis fits very well, too. So, you know, who's the person speaking was one thing. Then it was an overall description of the events, start to finish. And then the third and the fourth elements of the construct are the first level and second level factors, which was first level factors related to the objective situation in the sequence. What was the, no kidding, situation that was faced and the facts behind what was done and what was felt and whatever. And then the needs, the motives, and the perceptions were constituted as the second level factors. So that's sort of more of the interpretive subjective side. That was my take. And then the final one is a description of the behavioral and other effects of the attitudes. This is where dramaturgical coding is heavy on trying to capture attitudes as much as the facts of the situation. So basically, when they do these interviews and they've, you know, transcribed all of these events, that was how they broke it down into those five pieces to try to figure out what was the drivers and then what were sort of like the associated conditions. And it was 228 of those that they ultimately came up with. Quite a lot.
I don't know if it's too early to go into any particular critique at this stage. If it is, that's fine. We can add it in later. But in terms of the methodology, I did get a sense from reading the book that he certainly felt at the time that he was being quite revolutionary by using this critical instance method, and that he was very much coming at it from a quantitative background, and that any qualitative process was a big deal and was quite revolutionary, I guess, and adds validity to what he was doing. But the bit that was missing for me a little bit, and maybe we can talk about it later, was, you know, it was quite short term. It would have been fantastic to see maybe some long term participant observation of some of these settings, because I think a lot of the questions he's asking still, even though they are semi-structured and they're talking about a particular instance and the sequence, the long and the short of it, is just very specific, and I'm not sure it captures the totality of it.
I totally agree. Like, this is sort of a point that I resonate with. I felt that even just from a sort of reading perspective, we start off with some really good desires to capture the richness of data, but then breaching into that more quantitative foundation of collapsing and perhaps seeking out validity, or perhaps, I don't know, a reputational element in that kind of arena for that time, we then lose out. So I think one point that to a certain extent, not bugged me, but kind of bugged me at the end, is that if we move from phase three to phase four, so phase three, we've got the factors, recognition, for instance, and phase four, it's feeling of recognition or something like that. Like, it's if we're trying to really look into the needs and the values of people, which is something that is mentioned, it would have been really great, but maybe that was just too much of an early time for this to really sort of pursue that path till the end.
Yeah, those are very fair, all fair critiques. I mean, I think that the challenge is that we only have a partial understanding of what it is that you're looking for. Sometimes you may struggle to try to figure out, what did I actually find? I kind of had that same challenge when I'm looking at the first level and the second level factors, and this, he lists them out on page 50 at the end of chapter 6. The second level factors are all the same as the first level factors, just feelings, what he referred to as feelings or perceptions, as opposed to, you know, something different. The whole of part one is methodology. When you get to part two and you start talking about the results, I was struck by how stark the difference was when they looked at the results and what the factors that found themselves towards the motivation side of things and the factors that found themselves over to the hygiene side of things, and how stark they were. That sort of helped ameliorate maybe some of the questions we had about the methodology, because at least the outcomes were defensible. Let me just highlight then what it is that they did when they coded the sequences, so we can sort of close out, or, you know, sort of move on from the methodology. One of the things that they did was that they separated what they called high sequence from low sequence. And high and low is sort of like representative of levels of satisfaction. So you take the 228 stories, which were the stories that represented cases in which the worker was further motivated or more strongly motivated as a result. And those would be the high ones. And then which are the ones that created dissatisfaction, and those would be considered low. And that was a an important part of the analysis. It made a difference in terms of what was then figured out to be those things that were truly motivating as opposed to unmotivating. That's where you started to see the break between motivators versus hygiene factors, which ones resulted in high satisfaction and which ones resulted in low satisfaction.
So did his findings surprise you, Tom? Is that what you mean by stark? That, you know, look at the high sequences, only a small number of interrelated factors were responsible for the good feelings, and the good feelings relate to doing the job itself and the intrinsic content of the job rather than the context. Was that surprising?
No, by stark, I meant discrete. Yeah, I mean, very clearly separated. So, you know, for example, going forward to the factors which were listed, which basically were identified in chapter 7, table 3 on page 65, he lists out what were the 16 first level factors. And the top five, that these were for the high sequences, ones that created satisfaction. The five factors that were at the top of the list that not only presented with good feelings, but also durable feelings. So they did specify a difference between those things that were sort of short-term versus long-term. But like things like achievement, recognition, work itself, responsibility, and advancement were considered the dominant factors that contributed to satisfaction. And these were all representative of the no kidding work being done, as opposed to the rest of the list. And salary we can get to in a moment, which because he's separated that as a category unto itself, which is an interesting insight that I did not expect. But all of the other ones had to do with more like company policies, interpersonal relationships, environmental concerns. And those were far, far less likely to contribute to feelings of satisfaction. Their numbers were very, very small. It turns out that those were some of the very same factors that were much more strongly related to cases of dissatisfaction. So when you look at this list and you look at the way that he breaks it out in the table, you see like a set of things that produce satisfaction and a set of things that produce dissatisfaction. And there's not much crossover.
And the other thing that seemed to, or at least I didn't pick up between the pilot studies and the major study, there was mention of variations in intensity, or there was an acknowledgement of this. It felt like that kind of either it didn't yield results as were desired or sort of just kind of sat in the background. I don't know if anybody else picked that one up. Because I feel that this sort of, I've always had a little bit of an issue with this dichotomy of, you know, you like it or you don't like it, you love it or you don't love it. So I was at the beginning intrigued by seeing it come out, and then it got lost somewhere.
I think you're right. The intensity did sort of fade to the background. And I think that may have been one of those things where you're just not really prepared from the, like, I can imagine the trouble you would have with an interview of trying to figure out intensity. Because it's, even though we like to use Likert scales to sort of capture that, that doesn't always, you know, like, somebody can be really passionate about or express a lot of passion for something that wasn't all that intense in the end. Maybe it was discounted at the time, or just they had a harder time figuring out if something was long or short duration, or figuring out that something was satisfying or dissatisfying, which seemed a little bit more straightforward.
But to some extent, that also is perhaps not surprising given the methodological design. So to a certain extent, you're pushing it down kind of categories and boxes, and perhaps that's why this element, which hasn't got a clean cut, how intense is something that is very intense, has kind of not been part of the picture at the end.
Yeah, fair. Very, very fair. Okay, maybe we can go on to what they found as the results, because what they, after they figured out the factors, they went on to discuss the effects, and some of the effects that were particularly striking. Chapter 9, the categories of effects included performance, turnover, mental health, interpersonal relationships, and attitudinal effects. So in essence, what they're trying to do is say, what is the overall impact of these stories? You know, what are we seeing as a result of the accumulation of the effects of all of these individual stories? And four of them were categories that were results of signs of dissatisfaction, of problems. Improved performance, of course, was one, and it was the shortest section in the chapter. The other ones, like turnover, they gave several examples of either people who are leaving or were thinking of leaving, pulling out stories about those who very, very highly considering of wanting to leave, but might not now because of other factors, like, personal factors that would preclude them from being able to leave. And then also captured, how many thought of leaving, how many actually took steps, and how many of them ultimately did quit the job. Attitudes towards the company were very similar. There was a lot of instances of positive and negative change in attitude towards the company, which I took to be sort of like a similar to commitment, but maybe a little bit different. The mental health, definitely the mental health effects that they found, or the impacts on one's mental health, was emphasized much more in the low. The low sequence, meaning those who were really upset and dissatisfied were feeling manifestations, significant manifestations about depression and other factors. So what this was another thing I think that sort of contributed to the separation between the motivators and the hygiene factors, because the stressors on the job, those things that were related to interpersonal relations, were found to be dissatisfying, had all sorts of associated effects on the mental and the physical well-being of the dissatisfied employee, and basically represented conditions or factors that in order to for the company to perform, these were things that had to be alleviated. They are factors that had to be removed. And this was also kind of where I saw a lot more of a separation between, or where they were really seeing the difference between what was creating satisfaction versus dissatisfaction.
I was wondering on that note, because I was particularly fascinated by this thread around mental health, also called and labeled in this way. And I think to a certain extent, his background perhaps and the era has a strong role to play. So I'm pretty sure that the experiences of the war shed light on sort of darker sides of mental health that possibly sit in the background, or at least his attention were towards. But I'm thinking also that at that point in time, maybe we didn't have the current understanding or appreciation of the positive. So we tend to talk a lot about well-being. And even if it's used here as a word, I don't think it's used in a more positive sense. So from my reading of it, I think I understand why it's more the negatives that appear so dominantly, because I don't think there was the tools or the attention for the positives for a variety of reasons.
Yes, I agree. I hadn't really thought of that because, sometimes even in the modern discourse, mental health is usually thought of in, or, you know, when it comes up somewhat in the negative sense. But you're absolutely right that it was almost exclusively. He did say in page 91 that elation is one of the things that they also looked for. And they did identify some of the cases of high, in the high sequences of those who had long-term improvement in their mental health effect, which we take to be, or I take to be, basically significant increase in commitment to the organization. It's not the opposite of the negative side, I think. It's like two different phenomena, and, or at least I would take it as two different phenomena now, and not a spectrum in between the two.
Well, the whole theoretical framework that he's come up with in the theory comes from his dissertation, which he wrote, and I think it was entitled Mental Health is Not the Opposite of Mental Illness. So this is definitely informs what was on his mind when he was doing this. It's very interesting, actually, his approach to mental health versus mental illness, because it's often a distinction which isn't created nowadays, really. It seems to all be one and the same thing in a work context. But I think it's an important distinction to draw with this theory. And the other element of it that stands out for me in terms of mental health is he says in summary, when he's talking about looking back on the paper many years later and the research many years later, you know, people want to find out how to motivate people, how to get work done. And in summary, he basically says the most important part about motivation is keeping the sane people sane. That's his quote. So instead of focusing on, you know, the minority of people who do unfortunately suffer from mental illness, or, you know, through anyone's lifetime, we could all experience mental health episodes where, you know, our mental health isn't as good as it could be for just normal reasons in life, death, bereavement, breakdowns of marriages and stuff. But a lot of work focus, and it's interesting as well from a HR perspective now, is on mental health. But actually there's a distinction from that and mental illness, and that actually maybe the focus needs to be on keeping the sane sane rather than focusing on the negatives. I thought that was interesting anyway.
I loved that quote. It was, it's like he when he introduces his experience at Dachau, he said, the important bit that I've realized is for a society to keep sane, it's the sane people that need to be kept sane. And I think that was really also a powerful interpretation of what was happening in history at that time.
Just another positive that I took from the effects as well was he does talk about, you know, I guess that this caveats to the work as well. He does say throughout it, obviously he refers to men only. There isn't a mention of women throughout it, but he says these are a group of successful men, managerial and professional people, and also that they take their work home with them because they are professional, which is an interesting slant to take. But the more positive side of it is that from the research, it became obvious that high attitudes are more potent than the negative effects of low attitudes. So therefore, you know, in a work context, as a practitioner, if you have people with a high attitude and a positive attitude and are working well, that they have a bigger effect, arguably, than people who are being negative or have a low attitude, perhaps. But I guess there's flaws with it as well.
Well, that's one of the things that as we go on and discuss the impacts of this study to contemporary times, that's one particular finding that I struggled with carrying on. I do find it interesting that they saved the discussion of the sample to the very end of part two, as opposed to talking about it a little bit more up front, because the sample was largely engineers and accountants. I mean, and we're talking about professional individuals or those who work in professionalized fields. One of the things that naturally will come out in those sorts of people is this sense of recognition and achievement being of significant importance. Because in professional work, as we talked about in the Abbott episode a couple of years ago, the knowledge is the main driver of the profession. You know, how one is expert in or a master of that knowledge and its applicability to a variety of settings, that it's work that cannot be bureaucratized or not easily bureaucratized and stay professional. The achievement, the growth, the ability to advance, stability to stay current in their knowledge being so important, it would naturally fit with their context of what causes them to consider, you know, high, and also why, what kind of things would they feel would be in their way as generating these low sequence stories. I mean, one of the things that professions or professional people are really strong about is their autonomy, their ability to conduct their work. And of course, a lot of the feelings, a lot of the things that come out in this particular study mentioned as the satisfiers are precisely the sorts of things that would get in the way of a professional doing the work, right? So yeah, the sample does kind of play into the outcome. I don't think it invalidated or, you know, argues against their overall findings necessarily, but I think it just kind of shows that, hey, this is a first study and it's got to be examined in many other contexts in order to gain that validity. So the implications basically were the part three. And I thought that it was an interesting approach. The first chapter in it is essentially taking the original question that they ask, what do people want from their jobs? And based on it, sort of re-examining the literature and re-examining how they got to where they are. It comes to the conclusion, and it's a rather short chapter, it comes to the conclusion that satisfiers and dissatisfiers, terms that he put in quotes several times, really only work in one direction. So the satisfiers are what produces high sequence or greater satisfaction in the job. And the dissatisfiers are separate, discrete from the satisfiers, and produce negative effects. So that's where we then turn to the seminal chapter in the book, which is the motivation versus hygiene. And motivation, I think, is obviously pretty self-explanatory how they came up with that term. Hygiene might not be. So let me just quote the passage from page 113. When feelings of unhappiness were reported, they were not associated with the job itself, but with conditions that surround the doing of the job. These events suggest to the individual that the context in which he performs his work is unfair or disorganized, and as such represents to him an unhealthy psychological work environment. Factors involved in these situations we call factors of hygiene, for they act in a manner analogous to the principles of medical hygiene. Hygiene operates to remove health hazards from the environment of man. It is not a curative, it is rather a preventative. So, in essence, what management would do with these hygiene factors is they take action to prevent the onset of negative situations or the onset of these dissatisfiers. It basically enables conditions that allow the satisfiers to take hold. But the very clear point from the chapter is you take care of these hygiene factors, it will not lead to, in a direct fashion, satisfaction. That's the conclusion that Hertzberg draws.
I'm not sure if this is the right point in our conversation, but when I studied at university these basic concepts within organizations, I always started to think about, those people who change careers, people who perhaps sort of touch the ceiling and then decide to go elsewhere. Because what I feel that Hertzberg has focused on is really this one linear path. So you enter an organization, perhaps you're unhappy, and therefore you go to another similar organization, another similar job role, because something there is working better. But I think what perhaps wasn't even part of the landscape at that point in time was really, what if somebody just retrains and starts from scratch, something completely different, something else? And I think this is something that perhaps you didn't have data on. He didn't have individuals that were willing to undertake that journey. But I think it's an important part, at least of today's picture of education, of training, and of the work environment. The idea of, okay, I've done this career, but actually now I want another career. I want to do something else. And I don't know, I think those are stories that if they were part of this study, they would provide even further insights and a richness to this level of analysis.
It does raise a legitimate point because, you know, obviously the 1950s job mobility was not what, and certainly not among the professions. There was mobility was not quite as much of a thing as it is nowadays. Certainly on a first blush, if you are motivated and therefore satisfied with the prospects of advancement or recognition or the feeling of accomplishment through your work, then one would presume that that would carry over regardless of which organization you were in or which career you were in. And that would be sort of like the set of factors that you would judge where you are versus where you might think you should be. And certainly the hygiene factors carry over. The environment of the job, when we think about why people move, some of it is to escape a bad environment in one place where they feel like they're up against bureaucratic red tape or something like that, and they want to find another company, possibly another industry, where that red tape is, in theory anyway, doesn't exist. At least at a superficial level, there does seem to be a logic of it, or maybe the characters of the factors may change, but the nature of the factors wouldn't change regardless of workplace. Does that make sense?
I agree totally, Tom, about, you know, regardless of job or career, or the hygiene factors are definitely a basic for everybody, regardless of job. But I would question where the motivators come in terms of job satisfaction. I think a lot depends on the type of job, maybe in the industry, level of education, you know, and expectations. But maybe that's for a discussion later on.
Well, yeah, I think we can go ahead and head in that direction. There's a lot of things that we can discuss in terms of the different characters of the factors, perhaps, you know, how the factors themselves are understood from the 1950s to the present day. And I think salary, I casually jumped over salary when I was describing the table, but it was treated as a special case because it was an example of something that can be both a satisfier and dissatisfier. It was the one example that they came up with in that regard. And the question became, how was salary applied? And the way that they put it was, if it was salary, or basically pay, performance pay or specialty pay or something that was very specifically tied to recognition, like say a promotion or a merit-based promotion, or as a reward for a particular accomplishment, like a bonus for being employee of the month might be an example, then that's a motivator because it enhances, you know, the job situation itself. It enhances one's feeling of accomplishment, of recognition, etc. But the pay can also be a hygiene factor, especially when it comes to things like unfairness between different employees. We can definitely tie that with, say, gender inequality of pay, which is a very active conversation. We can talk about, say, pay raises that are just flat across the board, not tied to anything merit-wise. That would be considered a hygiene factor. So in that regard, you know, although salary in the table is sort of treated as a factor, a bifurcation, I think, between how it might be applied as a motivator versus how it might be applied as a dissatisfier or as a hygiene factor, in which we're trying to keep everybody happy by some measure of fairness, which may not be motivating to those employees who are looking to be recognized for specific or exceptional achievement.
I think depending on the context of the time as well, how much of a hygiene, how predominant it is as a hygiene factor in terms of dissatisfaction of employees, probably depends on the context of the times as well. You know, so for example, in the UK at the moment, we have the cost of living crisis, recession, everybody's feeling the squeeze. I would imagine it's got more impact as a hygiene factor than it would have ordinarily. And just in terms of when the study was done, the context of the times as well, I believe at that time in the US, employment levels were actually quite high. And the focus was very much on productivity and how could you make employees more productive. So I think that's interesting to add to the mix when we think about the study as well.
I would also add, connecting back to Tom's point around perceptions of fairness, the current conversations around inclusivity and diversity do imply a more nuanced understanding of, in this case, the hygiene factors, depending on personal circumstances, to be able to have that same level playing ground. And I think possibly for the features, the characteristics of the workforce of the US of that time and of these companies, because again, it's 9 specific companies of various sizes, but mostly manufacturing of various nature, if I'm not wrong. So we're probably talking about a workforce that, I don't know, if I were to close my eyes, probably looks very similar. So I don't know how much of diversity is needed to create variations in the hygiene factors. Interestingly, if we remember a little bit more about one of those pilot studies, one of the interviewees was not considered, and it was the one whose English wasn't at the level needed to provide data of a certain quality. So I'm supposing perhaps a migrant. That person, their story wasn't included for those reasons. But it's something that perhaps in terms of diversity and inclusion of today, of today's expectations around this topic, we would actually really require.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode.
We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.